And welcome back to Dads on the Air, coming to you around Australia on the Community Radio Network. In this program, we bring you informing and entertaining conversations with a wide range of interesting people on topics of fatherhood, family and parenting, men's and boys' issues, and more. And our special guest today is Dr. Will Davies, historian, writer and filmmaker, who began working with Film Australia in 1972, following his graduation from ANU. After a stint abroad where he worked at the BBC, he worked freelance in the emerging Australian film industry, including stints on a number of feature films, including Farlap, Monkey Grip and Hostage. In 1983, he produced his first television documentary and for the next 30 years produced a broad range of documentaries, corporate films and educational programs, mainly for the ABC and SBS, but also for Australian commercial channels and overseas broadcasters. Will has recently completed his PhD at ANU, and he's now leading battlefield tours, and he paddles his kayak. Will, welcome back to Dads on the Air.
Thanks, Bill, very much.
So, Will, you were last on this program in about 2 years ago, talking about your acclaimed book, The Forgotten, The Chinese Labour Corps on the Chinese Anzacs in the First World War. Before that, you appeared on this program with your book, The Last 100 Days. It's great to have you back, and we're especially interested in hearing from you as we approach Remembrance Day in 2020. The First World War went roughly from 1914 to 1918. After the German Spring Offensive in March 1918, the war was now very fluid. Can you give me a quick overview of the war for the Australians in 1918?
Yes, look, they'd come out of a very, very bad 1917. It had been a terrible year. And late 17, early 18, over that winter period, they were in training, rest and training, but they were also preparing for what they knew was a coming German advance. They knew the Germans were planning something, not quite what, but they did a lot of work. So this is a period, the Germans then launched their offensive in March 1918, and this became a period of desperate fighting in open country for the Australians. No trenches and fast deployment of these Australian divisions in the Somme Valley, the various German pushes. So out of this came famous such places as Albert, Dernancourt, Millencourt, and finally Villebretonneux. Now the famous battle at Villebretonneux on the 25th of April stopped the Germans finally and pushed them back to the outskirts of the town, the eastern outskirts, and from there they were able to push forward on the 4th of July, the Battle of Hamel, which pushed them further back from VB, Villebretonneux, and also the threat then to Amiens and Paris. And then on the 8th of August, the Allies launched the big Battle of Amiens, which started really the final 100 days of the war, which pushed the Germans back miles in the first day, something not seen in the war before. And then we had the Battle of Mont-Saint-Quentin and Peronne before the attack on the Hindenburg outpost lines and then the Hindenburg line itself in late September 1918.
Okay, so we're up to September now. What was the Australian situation, say, at the end of October and leading into November 1918?
Well, by the end of October, the AF had been out of the front line for 3 weeks. It was a difficult time, really. They were short of men. There'd been near mutinies with the breakup of the battalions to call for more reinforcements. And of course, the men would not have been aware of the various discussions and peace negotiations that were going on. It was also a time when men were leaving for Australia for what was called Australia leave. These were the men that had joined early, went to Gallipoli and were getting leave home. And Australia leave wasn't going home forever. It was really just leave to Australia. So they figured the war was going on. And the general attitude and morale at this point is that they were exhausted, that they were tired of what they saw fighting other people's battles. But it was, they were out of the line. They were away from the action, so they were basically safe.
Looking in hindsight, we know that the war ended on 11 November 1918, but for these Australian troops, it must have just seemed like it was going to be going on. They were rotating as usual and they expected to be back fighting.
Exactly, and I mean, they'd taken the Hindenburg line, they'd taken their final battle at Mont-Brehan, and they were literally preparing on the 10th and 11th of November to rotate back into the line. They continued their training as seriously as they had before. The Germans, of course, were on the run. The Allies, you know, by this late October couldn't keep up with them. You mean they were just cavalry units could, but they were just fleeing back to Germany. So the Australians, while the war was going on, they were out of action and they'd seen their last fighting.
Now, it was called the First World War, and we often talk about the Western Front. Can you just tell us briefly what is the Western Front?
Well, the Western Front came because the Germans found themselves confronted by a hostile enemy in the east with Russia and in the west with France and Britain. So it was facing two fronts and fighting for its survival. And it had always feared this sort of being compressed by hostiles on either side. You know, the Germans had beaten the French in 1871, but France was very, very active building defences, building their army, and certainly the threat on the western side was probably no greater than this massive, endless army of Russians, poorly equipped and trained, but on their eastern flank. So they had a western front and an eastern front.
And what was Australia's last action on that western front?
Well, it's sort of an unknown battle. It's the Australian tunnellers who had become famous for firing the two mines at Hill 60 in June 1917 were given a task, a very, very dangerous task, to lay a metal pre-constructed bridge across a lock. Now, this required doing so under fire, men physically carrying a heavy, heavy metal lock, bridge, so tanks could cross, and placing this in a position so that the advance could continue. This happened on the 5th of November, 1918, so we're 6 days before the end of the war. And in that action, I think somewhere between 3 and 5 Australians were killed, a very, very unhappy last action for Australians. There were also pilots, of course, that were flying units of artillery, and also the Australian Flying Corps was still active right through to the last day of the war.
Do we know who the last Australian was? That was killed?
Well, we do. It would have been one of these 3 or 5 boys at placing the bridge over the lock. I haven't got their name. I've been there. I've seen 3 of the graves. That's why I'm a bit unsure. I read that there was 5, but there's only 3 graves, and I don't think they would have lost anyone. Yeah, they would have been the last Australians. Of course, I don't know of any pilots being killed, but of course many men died on the 11th, the 12th, the 13th, the 14th from wounds and injuries received beforehand.
Yeah, just one more tragedy to add to the World War I tally.
Exactly.
Now, you just mentioned then the Australian tunnellers. Could you tell us about those Australian tunnellers, and particularly their action on the 5th of November 1918, which was just days before the end of the war?
The tunnellers had spent a very different war. They hadn't been working with Australian units. Even at the massive Battle of Messines, the Australians were at the southern end of the line, the tunnellers were at the very northern end of the line. Once the mines were fired in June 1917 at Messines, there was no more offensive tunnelling action. The lines moved too fast for the tunnellers to be able to get underground, build a long shaft, provide a mine under the Germans and blow it up. So the tunnelling war finished. What they did then, they worked to build underground shelters, to convert German bunker systems and basically, you know, make them face the other way. They built a huge underground shelter at Plug Street Wood, just south of Ypres. And this could take 1,500 men underground. It had gas-proof doors, and it was a wonderful, wonderful winter shelter, a safe, protective space for frontline troops. But they were active. Then they were tasked with doing things like clearing mines. They were asked to do, because the Germans, when they'd retreat, would leave huge delayed mines, and these might go off 3, 4, 5 days after they'd gone. So the poor old tunnellers are tasked with doing dangerous things like clearing booby traps and mines. And then, 5 days before the end of the war, 5th of November 1918, they're given this job of laying a metal bridge across a narrow lock so that tanks and the troops could cross. And this was done under fire. In the course of this, I think 3 to 5 Australians were killed, and they would have been certainly the last infantry or army individuals killed in the war. There were possibly a pilot or two, I'm not sure, but certainly many men died of their wounds after the armistice, of course.
And we're speaking today with Dr. Will Davies, And this is our Remembrance Day special for the 11th of November 2020. We might pause here and play a song. I think, Will, you've picked a song for us?
I have. Fleetwood Mac, Never Going Back Again.
That was Fleetwood Mac singing Never Going Back Again, a special choice by our guest today, Dr. Will Davies. I think probably the significance of that song is fairly obvious, and a great song from Fleetwood Mac. So, Will, we were just we're talking then about the tunnellers. While all this was going on, of course, in the background, there were some initiatives for peace. The Germans were getting more and more desperate, sending younger and younger troops into battle. What was the timeline for the German initiatives for peace? So perhaps when did it start, and what were the conditions?
Look, the August offensive, well, going back really before that, the German March offensive had really, the Germans had thrown everything they could at it. By the end of it, once I was stopped, they were then in a position that they'd suffered more casualties than the Allies. They'd lost a lot of guns, particularly stormtroopers. They'd lost their best men, and they were now exhausted themselves. So while the British were exhausted, the British now had their backs to the wall, the Germans were extended, and so by the August offensive on the 8th of August, which pushed the Germans back, and where they again suffered serious casualties and loss of equipment and guns, they realized that the war was on coming to an end. By September 18, the Germans were now exhausted with manpower, and the blockade, of course, that the British had laid around Germany had reduced the German population to starvation. And to add to their woes, there was widespread disillusionment of the Kaiser, the government, and even the military leadership. So it was no surprise on the 29th of September 1918 that Hindenburg and Ludendorff told the Kaiser that the war was lost and that the Germans should seek peace, based on US President Wilson's 14-point peace proposal. So the Germans, around them too, the German allies were disintegrating. Bulgaria in late September went, Turkey in late October, and Austria in early November. So by October there were also mass desertions in the army, and the navy had mutinied. On the 8th of November, a German delegation met with French General Foch, who handed them the harsh terms of surrender with 72 hours to consider. And Then on the following day, the Kaiser abducted and he fled to Holland. And then on 5 a.m. on the 11th of November, it was agreed to that a ceasefire would take effect at 11 a.m. that day. So that really is the lead up to that momentous moment.
And generally speaking, the armistice was observed at 11 a.m., but I guess to get the message out, there are always going to be a few that continued fighting.
There was... Look, there was this... I mean, the Americans were terrible. They really decided that they wanted to punish the Germans. There were talk of trying to use up all their ammunition, all their shells, and so they undertook advances against the Germans, offensive actions against the Germans that were desperate. And this fighting went on really to the last minute of the 11th of November. It's believed that 10,000 men became casualties on that last day of the war alone, of which 2,700 died. So it's extraordinary that they can send men to die in the last hours when it's totally unnecessary. If you've got a second, I can just open a book and give you a quick overview of those last deaths. According to the, and I'm reading this from my book, The Last 100 Days. According to the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, the last British soldier to die was Private George Edwin Ellison of the 5th Irish Lancers, who was killed at 9:30 a.m., just 90 minutes before the ceasefire. The last Frenchman to die, killed at 10:50 a.m., was a runner, delivering news of the armistice to his battalion. The last Canadian was Private George Lawrence Price of the 2nd Canadian Division, who was killed at Mons at 10:58. He is recognised as the last Empire soldier to have died. The last American was Private Henry Gunter, killed at 10:59, 1 minute before the end of the war. He was recognised officially to be the last Allied man killed in the Great War. The last German killed was a young officer called Thomas. As he approached a group of Americans to tell them that the war was over, he was shot. It was just after 11 a.m. Finally, the war was over.
Just one thing you mentioned then, which is always strikes me as extraordinary, but the Americans who came into the war late, and they'd presumably stocked up with their weapons and their bullets and their whatever, so what they didn't want to waste them. They thought, oh, well, we may as well shoot a few Germans.
You know, it's this perverse way of thinking. Rather than waking up saying, listen, boys, it's going to be, you know, ceasefire at 11, let's all just have another coffee. How could they mount an attack and just fire shells to kill people mercilessly in just... I can't believe it. It's beyond me too.
So on that that day of the armistice, so what were the Australians up to when the news came through? And you know, were there massive celebrations? How did they generally react?
Well, as I said, the Australians were out of the line. The battalions were in rest, although they were preparing. And you know, there's an interesting story of different battalions just going to the station and finding that. See, many of the Australians didn't believe that the war was actually over. Even though official things were read at parade, they all went, maybe they got it wrong. And in the book Some Mud, Private Lynch talks about not believing the war's over, and he did not believe it until he happened to be on a train going back to the line, and they saw French kids selling British papers which said the war was over. And it was an interesting way of, you know, how we trust news today. Well, they certainly did then. And that was the thing that they felt that the message was real. But the Australians were far more subdued. They tended to think, well, okay, it's over, but let's think of how we get home. Let's think of our mates that we're not going home with. It was unlike the French, who were famously rowdy and joyous, naturally as you would with the invader gone. The Australians were far more subdued, and, you know, I guess there were plenty of cases of men getting drunk and racing around doing silly things, but it was a different sense. They were there. Their focus was going home, and their focus was on remembering their mates.
I'm sure they would have... There would have been a lot of rumours circulating before the actual official announcement, so I guess it could. They might have just thought, "Oh, this is just one more rumour."
Exactly. I mean, who do we trust? Mm. You know, who do we trust? So, so it was a ceasefire, and then those conditions were placed on Germany to respect that ceasefire.
Were there celebrations in Australia when the news was...
There would have been. I don't know the extent of them, but I'm sure there would have been. Unlike British soldiers who were, you know, 25, 30 miles literally from London, Australians had a long way to go home, and the immediate thought, I guess, with the troops and with their families would be, when will I see my boy again, you know? And even if they got on the boat that day, it's another, you know, they won't be home, they might be home for Christmas, you know, but probably not. So the distance and the... And some other realities kicked in for us that weren't so apparent for others.
You just mentioned then the conditions of the armistice. I think most people that studied history at school would put some blame on those conditions for leading to the next World War. But what were those conditions?
Well, they were quite severe and very direct. I mean, the Germans had provided they had to put severe condition on the Russians when the Russians surrendered. And in a funny sort of way, the Allies had a precedent because they could say, well, look, you did it to the Russians, we're just doing it back. The first thing was unconditional surrender. No conditions, unconditional. The Germans had to release all Allied POWs, but German POWs were to be held. The Germans had to withdraw from all captured territories, Belgium, France in particular, to hand over, some of the things they had to hand over, 5,000 artillery pieces, 25,000 machine guns, 3,000 trench mortars, 1,700 aircraft, 500 locomotives, plus 50,000 rolling stock, and the German Navy. So that was just, righto, this is before you've got the Treaty of Versailles and anything follows up. This is simply the conditions of the armistice that they had to abide by immediately.
So I think a lot of people would bring those two things together with the Treaty of Versailles, but the Treaty of Versailles happened sometime after.
That didn't start till, I think, January 1919, and wasn't concluded till May 1919, but that only really filled out the details. This was the immediate conditions placed on Germany, and of course they had to get to the other side of the Rhine, get back into Germany, and they had to accept the presence of Allied troops. I mean, they had no choice. This was absolutely unconditional, which was a huge surprise to them because they did expect they would have been able to negotiate some of these points. Again, this is where you later get the idea of betrayal and, you know, the politicians let us down, sold us out, and that gave a position for Hitler and that post-war resurgence of German nationalism through fascism.
At that Treaty of Versailles, Australia was represented by Billy Hughes, who I think certainly made his presence felt. What did Australia get out of that treaty?
Well, I mean, obviously, right from the start, Billy Hughes was keen to have a prominent place at the table. And however, when it began in January 1919, it was dominated by the British Prime Minister Lloyd George and the French Premier Clemenceau, but also involved was President Wilson, the US President, and the Italian President. And so Billy Hughes was in pretty heavy company, but he wanted to ensure that Australia came out of the war with something and with a place. You've got to remember, we're a brand new nation. We're only, 19 years old as a nation, 18 years old. And so the importance of Australia as a new, independent, confident young nation needed to be stressed. So, you know, this, as I said, started in January. It finished. It was signed on the 28th of June 1919. And the proposals exceeded even the worst fears of the direst of pessimists. I mean, what was placed on Germany was very, very tough and difficult. Large parts of Germany were returned to Poland, to France, Belgium, and East Prussia. All their foreign colonies were dissolved. There was limits placed on them for German military rearmament and reparations, of course. So, you know, one thing was 40 million tons of coal which needed to be provided to France. So Germany was torn apart in so many ways by what conditions Versailles placed upon them, and this led to the rise of Nazism soon after.
So the end of World War One wasn't really the end of it, and having been there, I can say that I really think every Australian should go to the battlefields of France and relive our history. It's an experience you'll never forget. And I can only recommend that if you are planning, that you get in touch with our guest today, Dr. Will Davies, who does conduct battlefield tours. What's the best way of contacting you, Will?
We're in this awful limbo of being unable to fly at present. But if anyone's interested, please drop me an email, will@ Will Davies, that's one word, D-A-V-I-E-S, .net.au, and I can send you some details. I'm look, right now I'm hoping to go in April, May, and then do my usual 6-day Western Front and then a Normandy tour, but I fear we won't be flying till perhaps a year after that.
So we might be talking about Remembrance Day 2021, but we've run out of time today. It's been wonderful to have our special guest, Dr. Will Davies, back in the studio with us. So, Will, thank you very much for being on Dads on the Air.
Thanks, Bill, very much for having me.
And don't forget, we'd love to hear from any of our listeners. You can go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, send us an email, and we'll be in touch. If you'd like to listen to this show again or any of our shows, go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, or you can follow us on Facebook or Twitter. And we'll be back next week with another show on Dads on the Air.